Happy Thursday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to Perspectives on WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan, and our Thursday program here is going to be an exploration of many, many different things, especially good things to eat. We'll be talking about that. Also, some good things to read and some great information about upcoming events of great significance in our town. By the way, you're always welcome to be part of the conversation wherever and however it may wander at 850-414-1234, the telephone number. If you'd prefer to send an email, that address, perspectives@wfsu.org. Back in, 1994, the Florida legislature passed a bill mandating that the state's school kids learn about the Holocaust. And the Holocaust Education Resource Council has been providing materials, programs, guidance, other resources to continue and expand upon that educational imperative ever since. And today on Perspectives, we will find out what's coming up on that organization's very busy calendar in the weeks ahead. We'll learn more about the organization itself, and we have a very renowned and honored author who will be part of those festivities too, who is joining us on the program today. First, let's go around and meet the panel. This is an annual event. Barbara Goldstein, as co-founder of HERC, the Holocaust Education Resource Council, and thank you for coming back on and talking about it.
Thank you for having me here. We're very excited about our, I believe this is our eighth year of this annual Remembrance Dinner, and we just started with the very brainstorm idea with Susan Turner, who's sitting here, and now we have, we're almost full, actually. We have, I think, 20 more seats left to fill the dinner.
Wow.
It's October 10th, and this is our annual Remembrance Dinner that raises the funds to provide the resources for the schools to teach the Holocaust and to train the teachers, and that's our mission.
And so many people don't even realize that that is a legal imperative in the state of Florida and has
legislative
been,
mandate,
said.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sure is.
Right.
And it's a big job. Now, of course, an army needs to be well-fed in order to accomplish its mission. And Susan Turner, besides being one of the progenitors here of HERC, you also are in charge of the menu here for the upcoming dinner, right?
I am. And we have wonderful traditional food. You know, Jewish life is, you know, is encircled by food. And so we try to reflect that in the dinner and give everyone who comes a taste of what that's like.
Well, not only is the culinary offerings going to be tasty, but boy, the presentation is as well. And we have that gentleman here with us, too, on the phone, author James Grimes. He wrote Violins of Hope, Strings of the Holocaust, also made into a PBS special a few years back. Adrian Brody doing the narration. And I revisited that this morning. James, what a phenomenal book and a great presentation made from it there. And we are honored to have you here on Perspectives.
Thanks, Tom. Pleasure is mine.
Well, for the benefit of those folks maybe who have not caught the book or the presentation on PBS, a quick synopsis, if you would, sir. What exactly is that story about?
Yes, the project is called Violins of Hope, and it's a collection of instruments that were played by Jews in concentration camps and ghettos. And through it, we can learn how Jews, in the absolute worst of times, somehow held on to their violins, they held on to their humanity, and they held on to their sense of hope through making music.
And I believe this is going to be part of a presentation that will be coming back to your alma mater. I believe you got your doctorate from FSU, right?
That's correct, actually. Two master's degrees and a PhD. I went there for 2 years for a master's and loved it so much I stayed for seven.
Well, the Florida State University Symphony Orchestra is going to be picking up on this entire concept. I think that is going to be coming up as well. A concert inspired by Violins of Hope is going to be part of this entire observance in just a little bit. Right, Barbara?
Yeah, on Sunday, on October 13th at Ruby Diamond Auditorium. And James Grimes will be there also, myself, and the University Symphony Orchestra will be performing a music of resistance to partner with this, actually, this theme from the dinner that James will be speaking at.
James, this was something that was very, very endemic to not just spiritual uplift and trying to keep hope alive in the concentration camps. This was also a survival strategy on the part of folks, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Some folks in the Holocaust, in the concentration camps and the ghettos, owe their lives to their ability to make music. So music was just more than something they loved to do. It's how they stayed alive, and in many cases, how they spared the lives of their family members and friends.
Well, let's talk here a little bit about HERC in general before we go any further. And Barbara Goldstein is the co-founder of the Holocaust Education Resource Council. Was that founding purely in response to the legislative mandate?
Yeah, Rita Blank and I got calls. We're both children of survivors, and we were getting calls about 10 years ago or so to ask us to come in and share stories. And then the more calls we got, we kind of did more education opportunities. And we just went, this is how the bill Senator Monfort comes into now, being honored at the dinner. So at that time, Senator Monfort was the superintendent of schools. And so we went in to meet with him and discuss giving a presentation. He said, of course, I support this immediately. And from then on, we just created these amazing workshops and important learning days for the teachers. And on October 21st, we're presenting our 13th or 14th workshop that the teachers will come for the day, get important materials given back to them. Everything is free because of the funds raised from this dinner. And we'll be honoring Senator Monfort for helping us be the inspiration to provide so much education to the teachers.
This has been incorporated now into the curriculum, not only by law and by custom, but by necessity.
Well, sure, because the lessons from the Holocaust, whether it's through food or music or history or civics or in any way, we can teach the students across the board how these lessons should not be forgotten, whether it's music or art or understanding humanity is the most important thing, because our survivors are dying. And if we don't do this for their education of the purpose of being better, we got to change things.
Because you have that perpetual need for reminding everyone that this is a resonating point with everyone, not just Jews or Christians, but non-believers, with everybody, because this is a very human kind of connection we're talking about.
That's true, but in one of the ways is through music. It's just amazing, and Jay can talk about this, how music has become the voice of so many people that are not here any longer.
And James Grimes, has that ever been, we know what the Nazis were almost obsessive about documenting everything that occurred. Has that music been archived in recorded or written form that came out of the Holocaust? Does that exist?
Yes, mostly a lot of the songs that were created in the concentration camps and ghettos that the Jews created to express their humanity and to create a sense of community and normalcy in such horrible times. And we're lucky that shortly after the Holocaust, a lot of those folk songs were created on, they were recorded, and we have them, we've been able to transcribe them. And so we have this rich repertoire, but we also have music that reflects what's happened during the Holocaust and was written during the Holocaust. On the concert that the University Symphony Orchestra is performing this Sunday, they're starting with a short piece for string orchestra that was written by a prisoner in a camp, a ghetto called Theresienstadt. And he wrote this study for strings, and it was performed. And actually, we have not only the score to that and the parts that the University Symphony will be performing, but we have a video of the musicians playing it in Theresienstadt. It's the only part of the only video we have with audio from inside a concentration camp or ghetto. And it was actually recorded by the Nazis to be used as propaganda to show that there's music going on. So, you know, how bad can these places be? The Nazis were trying to convince the international community that Theresienstadt and other camps were simply what they called Jewish settlement areas, which, if that were true, would have been frankly no different from the Japanese internment camps in the United States. Of course, it was a huge lie, but the Nazis' interest in perpetuating that lie through the propaganda actually gives us this wonderful historical treasure of seeing the Jewish musicians perform and hearing them perform the music that was created there. And so we will recapture some of that this Sunday when the University Symphony Orchestra plays that very piece.
A concert inspired by Violins of Hope by James Grice. The Florida State University Symphony Orchestra playing that. Alexander Jimenez, the music director and conductor for this particular outing. Keith Dodson, assistant conductor. And Greg Sauer, I think so, a relation to Mandy, if I'm not mistaken, on cello. And that will be at Ruby Diamond Auditorium. That is coming up on October 13th. We invite your participation in this outing of Perspectives in the run-up to the Remembrance Dinner, October 10th. That is at Goodwood Museum and Gardens here in Tallahassee with a few tickets left. And as we head towards break, Barbara Goldstein, if anyone wants to pick up on those few remaining precious tickets, how do they do that?
They can reserve online and go to holocaustresources.org and make a reservation immediately, hopefully. Or you can send a check to the address on the website also.
Okay, terrific. We just want to let you know that those are going very quickly. And we invite your participation again in this edition of Perspectives at 850-414-1234 or drop us a line via email, perspectives@wfsu.org. We'll be right back. We are back on Perspectives, talking about HERC, the Holocaust Education Resource Council, and a reminder that you can always find the program online at WFSU.org. Just go to that aforementioned website, click on radio, pull down the local programs menu, and then click Perspectives. We archive past shows, try to have the latest program up within 24 hours of when it actually airs. On the air with us right now, HERC co-founder Barbara Goldstein, Susan Turner, event caterer of food, glorious food, and it is, and also James Grimes, the author of Violins of Hope, Strings of the Holocaust, who will be the featured speaker at the Remembrance Dinner October 10th at Goodwood Museum and Gardens. And Mr. Grimes, talk about these instruments that were used in the Holocaust and still exist in many instances to this day. We're not necessarily talking the Stradivarius style or quality of instrument. These, in many cases, were pretty pedestrian kinds of things, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. These were instruments, for the most part, that would have been used by amateurs in the home for their enjoyment. And often when they were ushered from their homes and put on these trains and sent to camps and ghettos, they were only able to bring just very few belongings, maybe 50 kilograms total. And it says a lot about how much they treasured their violins and how much they treasured music, that of all their possessions that they had to grab on the way out the door, many of them made sure to preserve their violins. And they played these instruments in the camps and ghettos, and now they've been restored by an Israeli violin maker by the name of Amnon Weinstein and his son Avshalom. And sometimes these instruments are in a terrible condition. It can take them up to a year and a half to restore them. But they do, and then they travel throughout the country and coming here to Tallahassee shortly. And the violins themselves are a separate type of survivor. As Barbara mentioned, we all know with every passing year we have fewer survivors, human survivors, to tell their stories. So these violins will exist for decades to come to tell their stories, and we can hear through them some of the voices that were silenced by the Holocaust and some of the voices that we've lost since.
It seems absolutely remarkable, almost incomprehensible, that the Nazis in the camps would have allowed the people to keep their violins when virtually all their other possessions were stripped from them upon arrival at the camps.
It really is inconceivable. They spoke earlier about Theresienstadt. That was kind of a very unique situation, that the Nazis were specifically trying to create something they could use for propaganda. But in other camps, even Auschwitz, there were orchestras. And these were ensembles comprised of prisoners who were forced to play as part of their forced labor. And the Nazis, for all of their evil, they somehow held on to their love for music. And the survivors would say how in the evenings, the Nazi guards, the SS guards, would come into their rooms and say, you know, will you please play for me? Sometimes they'd ask them to play even Jewish music, which was, of course, forbidden, or jazz, which in the Nazi system was doubly forbidden because it has both African-American and Jewish influences. And these SS guards would weep openly at the beauty of the music. And it's just really horrifying to think, how can the love of beauty and such hatred exist in the same person at the same time? And I think perhaps that really is one of the truest lessons of the Holocaust, though, is that this ability to hate, this ability to create otherness and think of people as less than ourselves, sadly, perhaps exists somewhat in all of us.
And that duality is something that, Barbara Goldstein, you, through the Holocaust Education Resource Council, try to impress upon young people, that, again, it's not just this person good, that person evil, but we all have elements of that in us, and we have to fight against the evil part on an ongoing basis, because we can tumble into that without even, you know, realizing it sometimes.
We have to be upstanders, whether in all different ways, and not stand by, and we have to listen, and do something if something is not right, and the music can make a can change people. Actually, I have a question though, Jay. Can you explain your inspiration of the book? Like, how did you begin the book, and why, and what mm-hmm. got you the starting of the book?
Yeah, great question, Barbara. Thank you. The university where I teach, I'm a professor of musicology at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. We actually brought 18 Violins of Hope to our city in 2012. It was the first time they'd been anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. And I wasn't part of that particular project. I was simply a faculty member. But as we were preparing for it, as in bringing it to Charlotte, as is true in Tallahassee and other cities, it takes years of building the partnerships and putting everything together. And I was just fascinated by the stories that I was hearing about these violins and the idea that music, which is something that I love and I've dedicated my career to, could be something more than that. It could make the difference whether I stay alive and whether I'm able to protect my family. So I took a trip out to Tel Aviv to meet with Amnon Weinstein, the Israeli violin maker who's at the heart of the project. And that was during that trip that I became inspired to write this book about the Violins of Hope.
That is an incredible story. That truly is. How many violins remain out of those you had 18 there and visiting in Charlotte, Jay? But how many total? Any guesstimate?
Well, I tell you, but if I talk to you tomorrow, that might change. The collection continues to grow.
Wow!
And by last count, there were over 80 instruments in the collection in all. As word gets out about this important collection, you know, families are looking for homes for these violins that played such a key role in their family's lives and in history in general. And the Violins of Hope Project has become a nice home for these instruments.
And you never know how many others might be out there that somehow wound up in a household somewhere.
I'm sorry for interrupting. When people pass away, they're finding things that never knew existed from this period of time. My father was a Holocaust survivor and passed away recently, and I located a briefcase in the closet, and my whole life never saw these papers before. So there's actually finding things that were never seen until now.
I have a question, Jay. Were there any other instruments that were found other than violins?
Yes, there are a few other instruments in the collection, and there's instruments here and there. But to be honest, there's something very unique about the connection of Jewish culture and violins. So we'll see violins in a much, much higher percentage. It's just there's a cultural relation that I'm not sure that there's any other instrument that has a culture that's so closely related to for centuries. And it's you think of all the great virtuoso of the 20th century. They tended to be Jewish. There's just something about Jews and the violins that go hand in hand throughout history. And we have a little piece of that in the Holocaust, but we certainly have a much higher number of violins than any other instrument.
Because the very first thing you hear in Fiddler on the Roof is the violin.
Exactly. That is not coincidental.
Which makes a lot of sense. We didn't talk about the menu that you have lined up here, Susan.
This is so much more
thing.
Interesting.
That's what I want to hear as well.
We'll feed you, I promise. One thing I was thinking about when Barbara was talking about what we teach through HERC is anti-Semitism is basically intolerance. And one way of diluting intolerance and hopefully eliminating it is by bringing people together. And the Jews were asked, the Israelites were commanded to have a communal meal early on in biblical days. And this is what we're having. We're having a communal meal. We're educating people. We're feeding them well, exposing them maybe to some food they've never eaten before, and hoping to put a dent in that intolerance.
Well, that is as old as humankind. You can't be beating someone up if your hands are full of food.
And your mouth.
And your mouth.
And food is hope. And unfortunately, the people in the concentration camps, how wonderful they had the music, because I know that uplifted them as they were starving. You know, and I know, Tom, you've seen this Holocaust Survivor Cookbook, which is a wonderful book. Filled with recipes of survivors. And to read this book is very moving. And we've taken many of the dishes that are in that book and we're serving them at the dinner as a reminder of what they went through and how lucky we all are and a connection to them.
Well, there's some culinary adventure there too, because if you have an unlimited pantry and a kitchen with all of the accoutrements that you need to really do a good meal, I'm not saying that that's easy, but it certainly makes it nowhere near as difficult as when you have all the limitations that the folks back then had. There was next to nothing.
Nothing. And so many people died of starvation. And, yeah, it's, you know, we're very lucky. You know, we have this bounty of food now. And so we use the food to do good.
Okay, food is love. At least
it is love.
That's what my Jewish godmother always said. Something else that is coming up, though, very contemporaneous, and this just emerged. I found this morning here, folks. It was just 3 weeks ago. Two lawmakers from South Florida want to increase the focus of Holocaust education in the Sunshine State. And I wanted to tap your thoughts on that, too. You got Kevin Rader, and he is a state senator, and State Representative Tina Polsky, both from Boca Raton, both Democrats. They brought out their version of the Holocaust Education Act that would have the Department of Education create curriculum standards and traditional public schools and charters and private schools, which accept vouchers, would have to follow. The good thing, not so good thing, Barbara, what's your take on that? Turning it over to DOE, saying, you guys do it here.
I just will say, let's talk about something else.
Okay. that's fair enough.
Talk about the music and the food and the education, because that's not a bill passed yet. That was just that hasn't gotten through anywhere yet. And it has, so if it's not passed, we don't have anything to look at. In other words, it was just written. We don't have any kind of formal passing of that bill. So without a passing, nobody can say what they're doing on that bill.
We'll have to wait and see what happens as we get closer to the legislative session.
Correct. Yeah. So that's why I'm going to leave it with no comment on that.
That's fine. Once there is bill making and rendering and all that kind of thing, and the drafting processes, or we'll go back and talk about that a little bit. But by the same token, you still have an imperative. There is a need to teach this in all schools.
Well, actually, so let me do backtrack. So over the summer, there was an incident in South Florida where there was an education principal that did comments were said that were addressed. And so this is bringing a lot of awareness out, a lot of educational needs, and a lot of questions are now arising as far as accountability. So going forward, that's where my job is as executive director of HERC is now going to be taking up a level of assessment and accountability. It's going to be expected throughout the state, actually. So we need more funding. We need more education materials because you have all the time new teachers and new students. And to learn about this is good. One of the best ways to change anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism is on the rise. There's no question, based on studies, based on activity, based on crimes. So we got to change by the education that we're doing in our schools.
And Florida is one of how many states that has this?
Florida is one of 10 states that are mandating it, but every state is really has their own curriculum, their own way of they manage it and account for it. So we're moving hard on doing educational programs now.
Well, Jay, you also are in the education business, obviously, and from your perch there at UNC Charlotte, how do you see this playing out as far as, again, the ongoing need to bring more attention, more focus to these issues and what they mean to today's generations, many of whom may not have had the advantages of being taught the actual history as part of their regular curriculum, where you now have to have a supplemental type of educational initiative like this to let them know, hey, this is what happened.
Right, absolutely. And I'm one of them who grew up through a public education system where we didn't talk about the Holocaust at all. So when I started down this venture, I kind of had to start from scratch and teach it to myself before I could start teaching it to others. And it really is a lesson in humanity and a warning to us all that, you know, hatred exists. It's a thin, slippery slope from looking down on someone, then to bullying, and then further and further down that slope into genocidal and all that. So it's just something we need to be very aware of, and we need to remember that this the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust, 6 million deaths, it's unfortunately not entirely unique in human history. It's one of the worst in Western civilization for sure, but genocide is a constant throughout human history and continues in various parts of the world. It's just things we need to be aware of, and these are obviously the worst in our history, but it's a lesson and not a Jewish story. When I first met with Amnon Weinstein in Tel Aviv, at one point he looked at me and he said, you know, why are you so interested in these violence from the Holocaust? It's, you know, he looked, I'm not, he knew that I'm not Jewish. He thought of it as a very Jewish story. And my response to him was, Amnon, this is not a Jewish story. This is a story about humanity. And this is a story that we all need to know and learn from.
You know, because first they came for, and we know that progression. Mm-hmm. We have revisited
exactly.
That enough. And yet in this day of social media, where you have instantaneous communication essentially worldwide, and the ability to form a fan base of whatever nefarious intent and purpose might be out there, is there even a greater and clearer and present danger today than perhaps even back in the 1930s and the 1940s? Barbara?
Yeah, I was just wanted to say, though, the 2020, which is next year, is the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. So we need to remember that, and the witnesses are no longer here at some very soon. So we need to be a witness for the witness, and these violins are witnesses also. We have to think of these instruments that this book is a witness, because everything we read in this book is an actual story to not forget.
in listening to what Barbara said, and a reason the education is so important, I was talking to someone who's almost 40 and has two small children in Leon County schools. She had never heard of Auschwitz. She'd never heard of Auschwitz. So therein, you know, the education needs to be out there. Her children will probably end up knowing more than she does, you know, through the education program in the schools. That's why it's so important. And the children will teach the adults,
you know. Yeah, that's what we're doing. I want to add also that our partnership with Tallahassee Community College is just so growing and moving forward that that's going to be a good resource for us to be. We're located on campus. And so come by and visit, and there's a whole library of books there to take care of, to handle all the education we need.
Yeah, I remember we were talking about that. It was almost ready to get out there and publicize the last time we were together.
Yeah, now we have a great program at TCC.
We are talking about the Holocaust Education Resource Council's many upcoming events here in our town, here on Perspectives. We'd love to hear from you, too, if you have a story, a question, a concern to share with us. Please give us a call, 850-414-1234, or drop us an email, perspectives@wfsu.org. We'll be right back. We are back on Perspectives in the run-up to the October 10th Remembrance Dinner, hosted by the Holocaust Education Resource Council at Goodwood Museum and Gardens, October 10th. We just talked about teaching the Holocaust, empowering students out at TCC, and that's coming up October 21st, which is a Monday, I believe, Barbara Goldstein. And there is another event that will happen in November, The Tattooist of Auschwitz.
Oh, that's a book that we are reading for our book group, which is really exciting, on November 14th. And we want to thank very much Midtown Reader. Going to give a shout out to Sally Bradshaw and her wonderful Midtown Readers. So that's where we hold our book group that meets every other month. So we did this month, of course, we read the Violence of Hope book. It was a great discussion. And then November 14th, the book, The Tattooist of Auschwitz. And then on January 9th, we're going to be reading The Unwanted by Michael Dobbs. This was just featured at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And then, because tying in with our next year's theme of liberation, we'll be reading the book The Liberators by Michael Hirsch, and that'll be our March meeting. So look up on our website and look up the book group, and this is a great opportunity to come to Midtown Reader. And wanted to also add that the teacher workshop on October 21st, if you know any teachers or if you're a teacher, sign up for our workshop, because that's also filling up, believe it or not. I just got two more teachers registered today. And you will be getting a lot of, the teachers will get, like I said, will get free resources. And we're starting a whole new, actually, initiative called the Holocaust Teacher Advocate Role at each school. And that advocate will be a state model for our whole new, bigger, actually, initiative of how Leon County can be part of a statewide approach to the to advocating for better education in the schools.
Oh, that's terrific. Okay. Hey, we're getting some action here on the phones at 850-414-1234. Let's check in with Roy first, who awaits. Hi, Roy. Thanks for calling Perspectives. Hello, Roy.
Oh, hey. I'm sorry. Hi, guys. A couple of comments here. I understood that Representative Jerry Thompson was also going to introduce a bill concerning both African-American history and Holocaust history. And then I just want to ask you all, not to downplay at all the importance of Holocaust history, but they are aware, are they not, that there is no statewide post-secondary history requirement in the state of Florida at all. I mean, you can go through a college or university in the state of Florida and never take any history if you want to. Some of us are trying to work on that, but I just wanted to make sure that they knew that. Anyway, thanks.
Hey, thank you, Roy. I really appreciate it. Well, we have dropped history requirements. I I'm dating myself again here. This is, you know, back when radio stations had coal-powered transmitters. but we had a history requirement in elementary school in every single grade, first through eighth. We didn't have middle school back then. See, it was very, very old. And then we had history requirements also at the high school level. And when I went to college, yes, there was a requirement you had at least 6 credits of American/world history before you could go on and get other courses. And that is no longer the way of the world. So, again, that's why Herc's here, right?
Is there a move to include that in high schools?
Well, high school, yes, they have what they call world history. But I think he's referring to college. Jay, am I right, or do you know, rather, that...
I'm not up on that in Florida.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yes. But I believe they're trying to change it now where history will be required, but it's not at this time.
And civics, too. Civics was eliminated also.
Yeah,
in ninth grade, it used to be a ninth grade requirement. So,
well, everything was towards you had a reading component and then a STEM or a math component, and even within the reading, you'd have a little social studies. But it was all very, very much attuned to standardized tests, so which were multiple choice, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes history
isn't.
I think
that's what the standards is. That's why we're revisiting the state standards and how does this get added into state standards. And if it's not in state standards, they're not going to teach it they're not going to teach the Holocaust if it's not in the standards.
And that's where it all comes in. Again, if there were comprehensive history being taught, yes, there would still be a need for such things as Herc. But you would have at least a basis upon which to grow some additional information that you would be bringing to the students. There would be a base learning thingy right there. So, let's see. Well, speaking of education, let's go to line 3. That's where Kate is. I think she is involved in the education system. So, hi, Kate. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hi. I'm glad that you're having this show. I wanted to say that Herc changed my life as an educator. I was a before and after school coordinator. And because of the Holocaust programs that they gave for educators, I was allowed to come. I learned an incredible amount. I had activism within my school, and we changed the way we dealt with our children because of our exposure. So our guidance programs and things like that were much different after our experience with having some of our teachers attend the Herc program that they offered every year, and they are the most outstanding thing. So if you're a teacher or a teacher's advocate out there, and you can get your teacher or educator to go to one of the programs, it's life-changing. It's just life-changing. Thank you so much, Barbara.
What school, can I ask what school this was at?
School of Arts and Sciences.
Oh, right. Yes. Yes, of course. Thank you.
Okay. And Kate, if I can ask you, you talked about the impact on the teachers. What about the impact on the kids?
Oh, you know, I had kids. I offered a Holocaust program in my after school. You know, it was like a little workshop you could come to. And I had tons of children sign up for that who were not Jewish, but came because they wanted to know about it. I mean, young people are our greatest advocates at fourth and fifth and sixth grade. They want to know how to be in this world, and they were fabulous. They came to that and very respectful, and it was great.
That is what a wonderful story. Kate, thanks so much for sharing that. We appreciate that. It was great to hear from you, and thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. James Grace, let me ask you about that impact as well, bringing to young people who, even though, let's face it, our lizard brain makes us kind of tribal regardless of circumstances, but there's something that young people have that we occasionally lose in later life, and that is this imperial sense of fairness.
Yes, absolutely. And there are many lessons, and her, as Kate mentioned, does such a wonderful job of sharing those messages. But, you know, these ideas of identity, and music is very, very crucial to one's sense of identity. So we can talk to, you know, what types of music listen to, what does it say about them, but how do we treat others? And that's really a lesson. And everybody who's been on the playground, who's been bullied, who has watched, stood by while someone else was bullied, understands these lessons of that we need to be able to take care of each other. We need to, as Barbara said, not be bystanders, but be upstanders in our communities.
That is something, again, that is beyond the historical ramifications of this. You are teaching life as well as here is something that happened at a particular place at a particular time. You're going much more universal than that, Barbara.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, Jay knows this also from the history part. We want to make sure the facts are right. I mean, you don't know how many times I've come into schools and had to look at dates and had to look at names, right, Jay? And you always have to make sure that you can't change history. And so even with these instruments, it's just everything has to be really clarified so that we can learn it and then continue the lessons, actually. That's why I feel this is so much more important. And as you just mentioned with that political bill, I want to make sure that even everything that gets addressed in every way, whether education or politically, that it's all for the benefit of learning what the students need to learn.
Because we have sometimes a tenuous relationship with the facts right now, too. Things are a little bit more, should we say, fluid than perhaps they once were. And Jay, when you see that violin, when you can hold one of those in your hands, that tangible, this is the proof. This is, again, as you said, the survivor from this situation.
Right. I mean, never again means... It does mean never again, but never again. What does never again mean? It means music, art. I mean, it all falls under that.
Well, we are back here for the benefit of folks who may have just joined us within the last half hour or so, talking to some of the progenitors of the Holocaust Education Resource Council. Of course, co-founder Barbara Goldstein with us, Susan Turner, who is really taking the point here with a spectacular menu coming up during the Remembrance Dinner here. And that's a throwback too here now, Susan, right?
Yes, it is. It really is. And basically, the evening is nourishing your soul and nourishing your body. And we will do that with ethnic foods. We have deli food. We have pastrami, corned beef. We have a whole deli set up like you're in New York going to a Jewish deli. And then we transport you to Israel, and we have Israeli food with tabbouleh and falafels and all sorts of Mediterranean-type food. And then we bring you back to the Jewish holiday table with brisket and potato pancakes and kugel, which is a noodle dish that people love. Basically because it tastes like dessert, and you can eat it with no guilt with your meal, and wonderful smoked salmon, and we have lots of food that is being donated, and then the fabulous desserts that we have, traditional Jewish desserts, rugala and cheesecake, and, you know, it's just a feast. It's feast for the eyes, feast for the body, feast for the soul.
But as I said, that this food was so important when they had no food to live, even though it was eating potato skins sometimes in the camps. But this is what in their mind kept them going. This is why they survived, because they dreamt about the food. So that to us is so important. And so they listened to the music and dreamt about the food and then were able to have courage and survive and then continue a great life after. That's what the whole beautiful thing is, the music and still plays on after. And then there's just the love that they have after. This is so wonderful to remember.
There's that wonderful book, In Memory's Kitchen, and it's handwritten. The women at night would talk about their favorite recipes in the camps, and they would write it on scraps of paper, and somehow they were saved, and they were formed into this book. And it's just, you read it and you can feel it. You can put your hand to the page and just feel it. And it's very moving to read that also.
James Grimes, you're going to be, of course, excerpts there from Violins of Hope, Strings of the Holocaust. Anything else you want to, without doing too many spoiler alerts here, advance us as far as your presentation on the 10th is concerned?
No, I just must say I'm really looking forward to being back in Tallahassee. It's a second home of mine, and being part of this very important institution, the HERC. And I just want to tack on this idea of nourishing the soul. I think that's really what the crux of this whole conversation has come down to, whether it's through the food, glorious food, or whether it's through the music. And that's, you know, in those worst times when they didn't have the food, they held on to the music and they kept singing to each other. And they would say, you know, while listening to the music, they could close their eyes and they'd be on the other side of those wired fences. As one of the survivors said, when they were listening to music, their SS captors had no idea that at that moment, at least spiritually, at least emotionally, they were all fugitives. They had all escaped, even if only for a moment in their minds.
Music as a transformational and also transportational kind of phenomena. And we forget that sometimes. We use music as like audio wallpaper. It's just back there. We're not really paying attention to it. But music does have a power that perhaps we have forgotten sometimes. And this is such a remarkable story here that these instruments bring that to us even today. Even when no one plays them, they're still singing somewhere deep down in the recesses, and you can pick up on that somehow. That is terrific. We really look forward to having you back here in town again, James. A few changes in Tallahassee since you were here for your graduate work, for sure. But are you going to take Jay on a tour of the old city, Barbara?
Yeah, this is, of course, especially the football game, the football team. No, but Jay knows his way, and it'll be exciting to have him back. And this will be a great opportunity to teach a lot of new people about music and the Holocaust.
Again, for the benefit of folks who maybe can avail themselves of a few remaining tickets to this event coming up October 10th, Goodwood Museum and Gardens, how do they do that, Barbara?
Oh, the website is holocaustresources.org, and reserve your tickets. You can do that online or send a check to P.O. Box 16282, Tallahassee 32317, or just call me and I'll make sure I can come get the check.
Careful.
But we're happy, and we're pretty much, it's a beautiful venue to have this event, and we're excited about it.
Beautiful venue, beautiful food, in fact, glorious food, we might even say, Susan Turner. And thank you for your participation on this as well. And James Grimes, you have a safe trip again back to Tallahassee, and we eagerly anticipate the stories that you'll be bringing us from Violins of Hope, Strings of the Holocaust, also that a recent award winner, I believe, as far as that publication was concerned. I think, Barbara? James' book just got a major accolade, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it did. He could talk about that because Jay, the book has been awarded many times, right?
Yes, and the largest, of course, being the National Jewish Book Award, which was
right.
a true honor that I'm still, a couple years after receiving it, still a little overwhelmed and in disbelief of.
Yeah. That was a big award that he got.
Yeah, but still, incredibly well-deserved. Mm-hmm. So, again,
thank you,
James Grimes, author of Violins of Hope, Strings of the Holocaust. Also, Susan Turner, event caterer of food, glorious food for the upcoming Remembrance Dinner at Goodwood Museum and Gardens. And as always, Barbara Goldstein, it is such a delight to have you here on Perspectives to talk about what...
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
What HERC is up to. Well, and we will reconnect later after the legislative session gets underway and see, okay, where are these guys want to go with some of this stuff here, which is, it is always good to keep an eye on lawmakers, we have found. That's a good thing to do. Thank you also, folks, for tuning into Perspectives Today, which is produced by WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. Taylor Cox pushing the buttons today, Lydell Rawls on the electronic interconnects, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Next week, we're going to be previewing Tallahassee's upcoming walk against Alzheimer's and chatting with some of the folks in the area who are so involved in the ongoing battle against this devastating affliction. That's ahead next Thursday right here on Perspectives. Have a good week.
Copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.